Mr. Holmes, were you... So when was it that you finally managed to get into the SBS?
In 1950.
And you said it was then called the small boat sections, not the special boat.
It went through a variety of names. The Royal Marines SBS, as they are now, of course, is a direct descendant of several wartime units. The best known, of course, would be the Royal Marine Boom Patrol Detachment, which was Blondie Hasler's canoeists who carried out the raid on Bordeaux Harbour. But it also was a descendant of the Combined Operation Pilotage Parties, their canoeists, the Detachment 385, which was a Royal Marine Special Force unit which was serving in the Far East, and the SBS, of course, element of the Special Air Service. Now, in one way or another, the Royal Marines inherited all those various tasks that had been performed by those types of units during the war. And the unit, when I joined it, was its actual title was Small Raids Wing. It was only a year or so after I joined it that there became a requirement to establish some small raiders, for lack of a better expression, in Germany, that the title of SBS came into being, and at that time it was known as the Special Boat Section, simply to give a title to a unit which was formed for a specific task. And two of the special boat sections were formed and were stationed in Germany with a naval unit called the Royal Naval Rhine Squadron. And those were the first two fully formed units after the war, which originated from the small raids wing.
It's quite a complicated story. So it was called the Small Raids Wing in 1950.
Yes.
And after that it was called the
Special Boat Sections. Special boat
section. When was it called the small boat section?
It was called the... No, I'm getting it wrong. Special Boat Wing. It changed its name to from the Small Raids Wing to the Special Boat Wing. And it wasn't until relatively recently that it had the title of Special Boat Service. Although that's basically what it's been doing all the time.
But at some stage it was called the Small Boat Sections.
Yes.
When was that?
That was in 1950. Or just 1951, sorry.
And in 1950 it was a small raids wing.
That's right.
Can you describe what you found of the organisation when you joined it and where it was based and as much detail as you can give me?
Yes, I think the most incredible thing, looking back such a long distance as it is now to 1950, is the complete lack of equipment that we had. There was virtually no new equipment. Everything that was being used for training was either wartime equipment, which had survived and was obviously by that stage was in a very poor state of repair, or was begged or borrowed from the other services. For example, all our diving training was undertaken with Davis submarine escape apparatus, which, as the name implies, were purely for individuals to escape from submerged submarines, and they weren't really suitable for use by frogmen, so-called, mainly because they were too flimsy, and secondly because the way they were constructed limited the number of times you could use them. They were never intended to be used time and time again, which obviously as a diver you're required to use them, and so they very quickly became able to take in water, which is obviously the last thing you want in a diving set. And as you probably know, an oxygen rebreathing set requires you to breathe your exhalation through a mixture of soda lime. And if the soda lime, of course, becomes wet and you then inhale, you inhale a very potent mixture of lime and water, which is very unpleasant. And the expression soda lime cocktails was used quite frequently at the time to describe these sets going wrong and people finishing up with burns to their mouth and throat. The suits that we were wearing were, again, wartime type suits, very stiff, very thick material, and most uncomfortable to dive with. And have very little comparison to the sort of thing that one sees today on the civilian market, where you have nice flexible neoprene suits, very close fitting, very comfortable. So I think my impression of those times, without any doubt, is the very poor standard of equipment that we had to start with. And that, of course, has changed over the years as the abilities of the section to do a particular job has improved, and because the powers that be have seen that having been able to do that sort of job, they do need the right sort of equipment to do it with. But it certainly wasn't true immediately after the war, and for the first 5 to 10 years after the war.
What was the caliber of the personnel and leadership of the unit when you joined it?
Extremely good. They had a strange system of introduction that, although you could volunteer to join the SBS, in order to be able to be accepted to do the tests and to pass the training, you had to be sponsored by someone. So this required you really to get to know someone who was already serving in the SBS and to convince them that you were the right type of person that they would want to serve alongside, and they would then sponsor you. The initial tests were nothing as hard as they are today. They were still quite physically demanding, but they're certainly a much higher standard is expected on entry now. But I think that they got round that shortfall by this business of requiring to be known by someone first. And certainly it was a system that worked very well, and the standard of people serving was extremely good.
How big a unit was it in those days?
About 30 was the total strength. Minute.
Yes, I'm surprised.
Yes, very small indeed. By 1951, when the first sections had been formed for service in Germany, the strength would have gone up to about 50. But the actual numbers at any one time have always been very small. I mean, we're talking basically about tasks that require to be undertaken by one or two or perhaps four men at a time. And so you really don't need a great number. As the tasks of the SBS have changed over the years, so their structure or an organisation has changed to meet it, and they are bigger, obviously, now than they were then.
Who was in charge of it when you joined?
There's a gentleman called Major Peyton Jones, who subsequently left the Royal Marines and became a curate in Devon. But the officer that I can remember most was a chap called Hugh Bruce, who was a Royal Marine officer who was captured as a young lieutenant at the fall of Calais early in the war. And obviously he went to a prison camp in Germany, and eventually, because of his escape attempts, he was put in Colditz, and he was one of the few people who actually managed to escape from Colditz although he never quite made a home run, because he, I understand, and I'm going by hearsay here, got as far as the Swiss border, actually crossed it, was then sold back to the Germans by the frontier guards. But certainly he didn't get home. He was back in Colditz to the end of the war. The reason I remember him most is because, presumably because of his background in Colditz of planning in the absolute greatest detail the way that they were going to escape, he applied the same reasoning to all the training and exercises that we did at the time as an SBS. And he was extremely good and extremely thorough. And a lot of the time in that period, we were concerned in testing the security of naval dockyards and air stations and so on as a means of exercising us in a role, but also to exercise dockyards and so on to test their defences. And Hugh Bruce was extremely good at planning those exercises and making them successful.
There was an incident about that time, the famous Commander Crabb incident. Do you remember anything about that?
Only what I've read in the press. He wasn't involved in any of the sphere of service life that I was ever in.
And so you were on this work testing the security of naval dockyards in Britain?
Yes. It was a very good system of improving our ability, especially with obviously a special boat section uses small craft or swimming as a means of introduction to an enemy area. And so testing dockyards was the ideal way of making sure that we were practiced and at the same time meeting some reliable opposition. And some of the exercises did become quite serious, because initially everything went our way, of course, that most of the places when they were tested would be fairly relaxed, despite the fact they would have everyone turned to and on watch. And on one naval air station we went to, it was decided that as a deception to the main attack on the control tower, we would clear the administration blocks of the ratings who were not on watch but who were asleep. And this was a three-story block, so we infiltrated into the air station, went up inside this block and threw thunder flashes and tear gas into all of the bedrooms, starting at the top and working down. So by the time we got to the ground floor, everyone was piling out of the windows and trying to get out of the building as fast as they could. And in the melee, we got away. And, of course, all the defences then started to concentrate on what they thought was where the main attack was. And our other chaps were able to get on and clear the control tower, plant dummy explosives and so on. Well, you only do that sort of thing once or twice, and the word gets around. And it wasn't very long before, whenever we carried out any of these exercises, we invariably got hit over the head by a pickaxe helve or something from one of the sailors or airmen who was on guard at the time. And so it was a good system, because it made everyone keep on their toes. But we didn't win every time by any means.
Sounds as though you could be seriously damaged.
Well, yes, I think we were all very lucky at different times. Yes. I remember on one occasion that Hugh Bruce and myself got into one of the naval air stations dressed as dockyard mateys, wearing our overalls and carrying a little tool bag. And we cut our way through the perimeter wire and quickly walked over to a hangar and found inside the hangar there was a boxing ring. Well, we had the task of creating a small diversion while a naval truck, which had a large box in the back of it full of our chaps with brain guns and thunder flashes and so on, tried to come in through the main entrance and make its way to deal with the control tower. And so we had to spend some time waiting for the point when we knew this truck was going to come up to the main gate. And we went over to this boxing ring and took out some of our tools and started undoing some of the bolts and then putting them back together again. But it wasn't very long before a petty officer and a small patrol working their way through all the hangars saw us and realised that we weren't who we were supposed to be as dockyard mateys. And so they marched us off. Hugh Bruce they took into an internal office, up some stairs to an internal office. And I was marched around the side of the hangar, presumably to go to the guard room. But I had a smoke grenade inside my overalls, so as soon as I got round the corner and I was a pace or two away from this chap with his rifle, I threw the smoke grenade at him and ran like mad. And as I went round the corner of the building, Hugh Bruce come flying out of the upstairs window. He'd simply gone into the room where he'd been marched by this petty officer, walked straight across the room, opened the window and jumped out. And it was those were the sort of exercises that we did. It worked very well because the truck with the box on the back with our chaps in it came through the main gate virtually at that moment. And so we managed to limp across and get on the back of it. And we'd had two more of our chaps take a section of fence down on the opposite end of the airfield. And we just drove straight out across the airfield and out.
Sounds as though you could easily have been shot.
Well, there was no live ammunition issued, so we were fairly safe from that point of view. But people used to take it all rather seriously, yeah.
This was in the 50s, was it?
Yes.
Yeah. The early or the late 50s?
Early 50s.
Mm. And presumably this was because they thought that there was a possibility that, say, the Russians might do it.
Absolutely. I think that at that time, of course, there was always this great fear of Russia walking into Europe and things turning very bad very quickly. So those sort of exercises were quite necessary.
Any other incidents you can remember from doing this testing work?
No, I think the only other interesting incident really was that at that time we were, as a branch, we were very interested in the Devizes canoe race, which is a non-stop race, or it is now a non-stop race from Devizes to Westminster Bridge, which involves a portage of your canoes over something like 75 locks, total distance is about 128 miles. And it was originally started off by, I believe, a scout group who did it as an expedition, took 2 or 3 days to do it. But of course, once the services became involved, they wanted to try and do it in one hit. And we entered for that in 1950, which was it always takes place at Easter every year, still going on even today. In fact, one of our Marines of the SBS is doing a sponsored paddle this year, and he must be in his mid-60s. But he's won it several times and holds one of the joint holders of the record for it, so he knows what he's doing. But in 1950, it was a particularly bad Easter. It was very cold. And we had ice over the canoe from all the paddle drips within a short space of time. And during the night we crossed several of these locks and got progressively more and more tired. And in the early hours of the morning we came to a lock at Reading, which we actually missed the lock and took the tributary that runs down by the side of it and went down over a weir. And when my chum and I shot this weir, there was a railway sleeper sticking up out of the water. And I put my arm out to fend off the stern of the canoe because I could see that we were going to hit it. And broke my wrist, and the bones in the wrist came through into the palm of the hand. So it was obvious I couldn't paddle any farther. So my canoeing oppo dropped me on the bank, and then he plodded on for another 30 miles before he finally succumbed to the cold. And I eventually found my way to Reading Hospital and got my hand set, and then caught a train back to Eastmead. Arrived there early in the morning. While this was going on, we'd had a small group nominated to go on board the submarine Afray, which was going to do an exercise off the Channel Islands. And a team of four, two canoes, were going to go on board the submarine to do a little exercise and then have 2 or 3 days in the Channel Islands on a nice quiet run ashore. So it was quite a nice trip, and people volunteered for it naturally. Well, my canoeing up on the devices race and myself both volunteered for it. Well, he was going as the sergeant in charge of the party, I was going as the corporal. And there were two Marines who were nominated. But of course I broke my wrist, so I couldn't go. And when I got to Hasler Hospital 24 hours later, my hand was black, and they thought perhaps I would lose it because the plaster had been put on too tight. And when I got to the hospital, rather worried in case I was going to lose my hand, I was relieved to see my canoeing oppo sitting up in bed with both his hands bandaged up and black as well. And apparently we both got frostbite, and so they were able to deal with it. It wasn't due to constriction of my plaster after all. But as a result of that, neither of us, of course, could go on HMS Afray. So unfortunately, two other NCOs went, and equally unfortunately, they were the ones that went down with it.
So it was a submarine that was lost.
That's right, off the Channel Islands, in the Channel Deep.
Was there ever any danger of the unit being broken up and dissolved?
No, I don't think so. I think very slowly, but progressively after the end of the war, the standard of training, the operational requirements, of course, which always create the need for any form of unit, became more obvious to the planners, I think. And the ability and the structure of the SBS eventually started changing and expanding, and the equipment was improved in order for them to be able to meet these operational requirements. But I don't think there was ever any point where they were seriously being considered as being disbanded, not after the Second World War.
Did you do any other jobs apart from testing defences of Royal Naval Air Station?
Yes, we had several tasks in when we were stationed in Germany, because after I'd finished my training, I eventually went to the section that was stationed on the Rhine for 2 years. And our task then was to deny all the shipping on the Rhine to the Russians should they move into Europe. The Belgians and the French both had their own Rhine squadrons stationed at their own zones of the Rhine. And our task, as I say, was to move all the barges as much as we could away from the East Bank. And deny their use to the Russians in crossing the river, because the Rhine was seen as the main first stopping point. But while we were stationed in Germany, we had the terrible Dutch floods, of course, in 1953. And the Rhine squadron, which had annually gone down to Holland for its spring cruise, as being a typical naval establishment, you had to have cruises for the landing craft that were stationed in the Rhine squadron. And so we had a spring cruise that each year went to Holland, which enabled us to get some work in with the Dutch Marines. And then in the autumn, we would go up the Rhine to the wine festival area and carry out exercises up there and enjoy the wine festival at the same time. It was a very, very nice period. But of course, as a result of working down in Holland with the Dutch Marines, once the floods inundated a lot of the islands there, we had to go down and help in the relief work. And obviously, because we were divers, we were our diving ability was used. We went to an island called Schouwen, with a little town of Zierikzee, some mile or so inland, up a canal. And the whole of the island was inundated. Something like 2,000 people had lost their lives, something. But by the time we got there, it wasn't the dead people that they were particularly concerned about, it was the dead livestock. And there was a great danger of a typhoid epidemic spreading through the broken water supply system. And so for over a fortnight, we spent all our time searching for stopcocks, which were under about 10 to 15 foot of water. The Dutch have a very good system because they have their stopcock markers on buildings and on telephone posts well up above possible flood water, so that you do stand a good chance of finding them. And the only problems we had with finding them was when buildings had collapsed and they were had to move the rubble first before you could get at the stopcock. And then you would simply put in a T-bar and turn it 50 times and turn off the water supply to that particular section. Sounds easy, but it's very difficult to turn a T-bar when you're in a diving suit with no weighted boots. We were wearing fins, of course, and so you tend to just spin round on the top of it instead of being able to... Eventually, we worked out a technique of locking ourselves around it and twisting it, trying to do a twist and shake, probably the best way of describing it. But it was probably the worst diving most of us had done up to that time, because it was in January, February. And the water temperature was certainly only just above freezing, and the air temperature way below freezing. So that every time you come to the surface, your valves on your mouthpiece and on your counter lung of your breathing set all froze up, and you're constantly breaking down. So from that point of view, it was memorable. And of course, in those days, we didn't have neoprene, and so we didn't have gloves and we didn't have hoods. And so the amount of time you could spend in the water was very limited. We used to spend about 20 minutes, and then another chap would go down and we'd get into the forward compartment of the duck that we were working from. And
what's neoprene?
Neoprene is a sort of 3/16 of an inch foam rubber, which I don't think was introduced until about, or wasn't manufactured until about 1960-something. All we had, of course, was a rubberized canvas, which made a watertight suit, but it was too stiff to make things like gloves out of. You could have gloves, but they were so massive that you would...